This is the best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
I looked at that play. I watched it. I have watched it like 30 times. The only thing I would say that could eliminate all of the doubt and all of the uncertainty is if we had a camera right from the top of the stadium that looks directly down over the outfield wall to see whether or not officially Mookie Betts was into the crowd or whether the crowd was leaning out over that yellow stripe there. But to me, this is pretty clear. And if there is doubt, to me, doubt should go to the fans here. If there is doubt about whether or not Mookie Betts would have made the play, remember, you don't have a right in Major League Baseball to be able to go into the crowd and make a catch. Now, you can do it, but the moment you're chasing, for instance, a foul ball, and you are reaching into the crowd to try to make a play, the fan has the same right to that foul ball as the player. And so oftentimes what you'll see if a fan is intelligent, this is where Bartman got in trouble, was if the ball is going into the stands and you are playing at home, you often see intelligent fans lean out of the way, hey, let me try to do everything I can to let this guy make the catch, right? To let the player get into the crowd and make the catch. He can reach into the crowd and make that catch. But it's not fan interference when a player reaches into the crowd and moves into the space of the fan. And I think that's what we saw with Mookie Betts and the play that he tried to make is he was making such a phenomenal play when he went into the crowd. He was leaping again. If you just look at Mookie Betts on that play, what he had to do to get his glove into proximity of that baseball was a phenomenally athletic play. But I believe he was clearly reaching over the fence and attempting to steal a home run from Altuve to take it away from the Houston Astros. I don't think there's any doubt. I know Joe West made this call, and it seems like controversy follows Joe West and has for decades. And I know this rule has been implemented and refined over the years, going all the way back to the Jeffrey Meyer play with the Yankees where he clearly reached out and basically caught a ball and brought it in for a home run, even though it would have otherwise been caught. This is not that. This is not that scenario at all. I think beyond a shadow of a doubt, that should have been a home run for the Houston Astros. You have instant replay review. I don't know how an instant replay review, you have established that the tie goes to the runner in baseball, right? Everybody knows that rule. If the ball arrives simultaneously with the base runner, then the tie always goes to the base runner. Why would the tie not go to the fan here? Do you agree or disagree with me, Jason Martin?
I agree with you. Mookie Betts maybe could have made the play. There's one angle where it looks like his glove was closed and he wasn't going to make the play. I'm not going to say yes or no to that. The one thing about it that continues to kind of baffle me is this seems to be the only place in sports where this can happen because of how close the fans are. When you get to the outfield situation, I know it's part of being on the action, but I know, you know, Kate Upton went on Twitter last night and took a lot because she commented on the situation and people started calling her princess and things like that, and she fought back. But one of the things she says, which is something I've thought for a long time, is she tweets out, so if a player is in the stands, fans are supposed to move over. If those are the rules, MLB shouldn't let fans sit there. They didn't reach over the fence. And I think she's right. Like, is there something we should be talking about in terms of creating an alley of just a couple of feet so that this can't happen? Because the problem here is this isn't like a lot of other sports where you have a ton of other opportunities to win the game. Yes, this happened early. But baseball is a game of such rare opportunity when it comes to scoring runs that even though this happened that early, it absolutely could have changed this entire game, meaning it could have changed this entire series and could have changed the World Series as well.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. Now, my position is, in just a general perspective, I don't have a problem with the fans being right there on top of the field. I do think that if you wanted to be 100% sure whether or not fan interference was in play, you could have a camera that runs down or is at the ceiling or whatever that gives you a definite view, much like you have down the goal line. And we talked about this on the show before. One of the frustrating things I think about, for instance, college football replay is, and I think about the Mississippi State Auburn game a couple of weeks ago, I didn't think that Nick Fitzgerald got in, but we don't have a definitive line oftentimes because there's not as many cameras. The NFL, they have more cameras, so we tend to get better angles. If baseball is 100% concerned about this, in areas where you could have a fan interference play, it seems to me, especially in postseason, when they're spending so much money to make sure that they get those games right and have so many extra umpires and everything else out there. Because remember, Joe West did have a better vantage point than you would have typically in a regular season game because there are extra umpires out there. Having said that, why not eliminate any doubt at all and just have a shot that comes straight down? And if Mookie Betts is reaching over the wall, which it appeared to me he was, then he has no more right to the ball than the fan does, and therefore it would have been a home run.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis, weeknights at 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
We welcome in a guy that we've had on this show since very much close to the beginning, which is now over 2 years ago, the great John Morosi on Twitter, at John Morosi. Take the H out of his first name if you want to follow him, J-O-N. John, how are you today?
Outstanding. Still processing the evening's events in Major League Baseball.
All right. Home run, fan interference. Where do you come down on this? I know you knew. It's not like you're surprised that that's the first thing I have to ask you.
No, I mean, it's the seminal question in the game right now. Here's my view of it. It looked to me that the contact between Mookie Betts' glove and the fans occurred on the fans' side. If you imagine that imaginary plane going up and down there at the fence, it seemed to me that contact took place on the fans' side of the field as opposed to anyone deliberately reaching over that plane and interfering with the catch. I believe that if the call on the field had been home run, that the replay would have stood on that as well. So that basically it was going to come down to whatever Joe West had said on the field. And in the moment, Joe had it as interference, and he made the call that he made. So I think that it should have been a home run. And if you wind it back to the beginning of the play, but I also understand that once it went to replay, that while I believe that the contact happened on the fan side of the wall, that understanding the way the replay works, that there was probably insufficient evidence for MLB to overturn it. And I think interestingly, and this was pointed out by Jeff Passan in his column this morning, that what would have been a definitive replay was somewhat obstructed by an Astros security guard in right field, which circled back to what had happened earlier in the day, where there was the conversation about the Astros employee filming other teams' activities and making sure that there was no subterfuge going on. So the day began with an Astros employee next to the dugout, and in many ways it was decided by one who was rather just by luck not stationed in the right spot there in right field to get a clear view of things. Irony upon ironies, and then the reality is now the Red Sox have a commanding lead in this series.
Yeah, John, I think Astros manager A.J. Hinch kind of joked about it and said the cameras have not been going our way over the last few days, to say the least. I think Jeff may ask you a little bit more about the angles as well, but one thing that I continue to think about, it's so unique and germane to baseball in a way that I'm not sure it should be. Isn't there a happy medium here where you can create an alley between the outfield fence and the first row of fan seats where they're actually allowed to sit, maybe just a foot, maybe 18 inches, just to eliminate this happening? I know it doesn't happen a lot, but the problem, at least the way I view it, is baseball is a game of such limited opportunity that any play is magnified. And even though that happens so early in the game, there's just not as many chances to score in baseball as there are in many other sports. And I just look at it and say, why can't we fix this to where the fan can't interfere and it's clear either way what's happening?
Well, that's a fair question. I would say this, that first of all, I think anytime that you create a gap or put additional spaces between where the fans are sitting and the field of play, even if there's a floor right there and it's just a matter of creating an aisle, I think on some level that does bring up some fan safety concerns, where if there's more space, could you then lose your balance and all of a sudden tumble onto the field of play? I think that MLB would be a little wary of doing that. Also, candidly, those are really high-grossing seats that you're putting right on top of the field that fans want to sit in for exciting reasons, just sort of like we saw last night. I think that ballparks have been constructed this way for a long time, and I don't see them changing. I think it's a very fair question, but I think given the way that ballparks are made nowadays, and this, I think, is one of the reasons why replay is so essential, and I realize it didn't really help the Astros last night, but every ballpark is so unique in terms of where its boundaries are. Houston probably maybe is the best example of it, because you've got that different, the yellow line is sort of juts across the outfield in a very sharp way, even up across the facade in left field, where balls that look like they go off the wall are actually home runs. So the job of the umpires has gotten harder and harder as ballparks have put in more intricate fences and outfield structures. It's a very fair question that you ask, but I think the reality is we are probably not going to see wholesale changes across the major leagues in this area.
All right, John. I think last night brought up an interesting point about umpiring. You know, we had Joe West out there making that call, and, you know, he's got tenure, right? No one's going to mess with Joe West. Do you think that some of this call was like they're just not going to overrule the big dog in charge?
Well, it's a fair question to ask, but I think probably not. I just think the reality was that the replays were inconclusive. I think that would have been that probably would have been their outcome no matter what. Who was making the original call, whether it was Joe or a rookie umpire? I think that there was maybe initially with the replay program a little bit of reluctance to say your colleague was wrong. I think that there might have been just on a human level. But that call is so important, and the review lasted so long, several minutes, that I think that MLB was certainly doing everything they could to get the call right. And I thought, as you're looking at it from left center field, there was that one. If you look at some of the replays that you can see on MLB.com, I believe there was one which from the camera that was probably on top of the Crawford boxes or in center field, where it looked to me like the contact, as I mentioned earlier, was probably over into the stands as opposed to being over the field of play, based on the sort of the side oblique angle of where Mookie was and where the fans were. I think that contact was happening in the crowd, but it wasn't. I can understand if MLB said it wasn't completely convincing. So I just think that it was a matter of a lack of 100% clarity on where it was. From my standpoint, I was about 95% sure, just in my own amateur view of things, that it was contact that happened above the wall and into the fan side of the field. And if that's not good enough, it's not good enough. But that's to me a really intriguing part of the decision. But I think, in all honesty, MLB dealt with it as forthrightly as they could. And the standard is that they've got to be clear and convincing. And there was apparently a very small lack of clarity on exactly where that contact took place.
Before we get to Clayton Kershaw's performance, Game 5 tonight, David Price, Justin Verlander. David Price, can he give them five solid tonight, or are they just hoping that maybe he gets three good innings and they can go to their bullpen?
Well, I certainly think David's capable of going deeper into the game. And we saw, I actually think his earlier start in this series was okay. I think he... The stuff was lively. I know that his postseason track record is what it is, but that was a big win for the Red Sox. Wasn't he? Didn't get the victory himself, but he had pitched well enough in a game that his team won, which I think was a key step for the Red Sox and a key step for David Price. So I think certainly that the way things have gone, asking 4 to 5 innings is very realistic, and I'm sure from David's standpoint he would love to get to five, because then of course you can qualify for the win if your team is ahead. I think we'd be remiss too if we didn't mention a key part of the way the Red Sox played last night, and certainly the way the game ended, was Benintendi's catch in left field,
which
amid all the controversy, and certainly again the controversy is well placed, because if that Altuve home run is a homer, the Astros have two runs in the first inning in a game in which they scored zero runs and lost by two. So that's the beginning part. The end part was Benintendi, and again, Jeff Passan's column did a great job of illustrating this. He stepped in briefly right before that final pitch, about a step and a half, and that's the difference. I mean, that is a dream baseball scenario. As controversial as the call was, that is, as a baseball fan, bases loaded, two out, two-run game, bottom of the ninth, best hitter that you've got, a sinking line drive, the game's going to end right there. And I love the way that it played out, just from the standpoint of the drama. And then, of course, it was a great catch by Benintendi, and the Red Sox had the lead.
John Morosi, our guest here on Outkick the Coverage. Follow him on Twitter at J-O-N Morosi. John, how close are we to potentially erasing the Clayton Kershaw postseason curse talk that always crops up because he's kind of been the dominant pinching name for the last decade, so he takes a lot more flack than maybe other guys would. But what a gem he put on yesterday. It feels like we're getting to the point where that narrative is becoming more prevalent from haters and not even objective baseball types.
I would agree. To me, it was with Clayton, I think he dispelled that a couple of years ago, really, and probably even earlier than that. I remember when he won a game in 2015 to force the division series back to New York. He won a game, or actually it was back to L.A. at the time, I think. He won a game four in New York to avoid elimination. That's now 3 years ago. He's had a lot of really good starts that I think were spoiled by a Dodger bullpen that wasn't good enough, and this even goes back to the Mattingly years where Donnie kept him in the games longer than they probably should have. But I think he's had a lot of big moments. He, of course, won the pennant clincher last year in Chicago. Huge game yesterday, seven innings, one earned. Very impressive. I thought he was in command from the very beginning. So, to me, the Kershaw postseason narrative is fundamentally different than the Price one. The Price one has some real struggles. I think Clayton has had probably more good starts than bad in the last several years in the playoffs. So, I think that's, to me, the book is closed on that. It's just a matter of can he do it in the World Series, which, of course, last year in Game 5 was a struggle for him. But that was a huge, huge outing for his team yesterday, to take a 3-2 lead going back to Milwaukee. And what could have been, obviously, his final start as a Dodger at Dodger Stadium, depending on how things play out in the balance of the series, and then, of course, into the postseason and the offseason with his opt-out in his contract. So it was a multi-layered start for the Dodgers, for Kershaw, and they could not have asked for more than what their ace gave them yesterday. So, and of course, right now he'd be lined up to likely pitch. As I'm thinking about the days here in my head, he would be on regular rest to start Game 1 of the World Series should the Dodgers advance.
We got about a minute left here. Last question about this series. The Brewers seem to not be able to win without Hader pitching. I know Council's kind of talked about having to find ways to win without him, but obviously if he throws in Game 6, he'll probably won't be able to throw in Game 7. How do the Brewers win this series without having Hader pitch at all?
Well, I think the way they're at right now is of course, Hader has today off, travel day. I would imagine he has pitched some on consecutive days, and so I think if he goes two innings in Game 6, he could probably still be good for one inning in Game 7, but maybe not the same level of effectiveness. The Brewers, I find their strategy fascinating. Of course, in Game 5, they start with Miley and bring in Brandon Woodruff after the first batter of the game, which is unique, and certainly trying to take advantage of the Dodgers. This is a strategy that you take when you don't have four aces lined up in your playoff rotation, which, by the way, very few teams do. And I'm fine with it. I think when you look at the Dodgers, I believe they've got a payroll advantage of about 3-1 over the Brewers. And so if you've got to be imaginative and creative to stand toe-to-toe, then that's fine. But that's the Brewers that believe they've got to play that way to win, and they've had some success. But I think ultimately yesterday was a very telling moment where they've got to have a guy come in and pitch one batter and then come back and start Game 6. There's a lot of strategic elements there for the Brewers that I think eventually will more than likely catch up with you unless you're able to really pitch extraordinarily well every single game.
John, always a pleasure. We will talk to you next week. We should have a World Series matchup. Price versus Verlander ought to be fun tonight.
Can't wait. A couple former teammates there, a couple former Cy Young Award winners. So should be great baseball tonight and then, of course, for the rest of the month.
All right, that is John Morosi. Follow him on Twitter at J-O-M Morosi.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
LeBron is not done. LeBron is sort of the story today. I think, do we still have the phone caller, or is he gone? All right, Dub is telling me no, he is gone, so he did not wait around. LeBron James playing his first game in a Lakers uniform tonight against the Portland Trail Blazers. I've said before, I think the Lakers make the playoffs because they have LeBron. One thing LeBron James does do generally is make everybody around him better, and I do think that some of the guys that you might not know their names yet, you're going to know. I think he's going to make the Brandon Ingrams of the world better. I do think that they're going to be the story. I think he's I think he's got 7 games on national television just in the first month of the season. Like, the Lakers are going to be overexposed to another level, even from what the Lakers generally are, because of just the circumference of LeBron James's impact and his outsized influence on the league. But I'm going to be watching. Like, I mean, we can sit here and talk about, oh, LeBron James fatigue, but I'm going to be watching LeBron James quite a bit this season. Where I'm at with the Lakers in terms of just kind of a win-loss total, I think this can kind of become a roundabout discussion. If you have thoughts, 877-996-6369, you can chime in with your thoughts on LeBron. But I feel like this is about a 47-win team. I don't think they're going to win 50. I think the West, almost every team in the West is better than they were a season ago. Phoenix won last night. Devin Booker had a really nice game. DeAndre Ayton had, 18, 10, and 6, and he was 8 of 11, so he looked pretty good as well. I think Sacramento is a better team than they have been over the past half decade. The Clippers made themselves better in the offseason. Denver is a very dangerous team. Utah is a dangerous team. Portland is a dangerous team. New Orleans is a dangerous team. All of these teams in the West are going to be tough. One of the things that LeBron had the benefit of in the regular seasons in Cleveland and in Miami was that much of the rest of the conference were cakewalks during the regular season. These are going to be dogfights every night for the Lakers. And I'm curious, at his age, Jeff, how LeBron holds up if he has to go out there and play to a high level on a night-to-night basis to win regular season games.
You know, you mentioned the 7 national TV games, whatever it was, 5 early in the season. That was my first thought, is how hard is LeBron going to play in some of these games, considering that, you know, he's been a guy that's been really good at kind of conserving his energy for the playoffs. And look, I think he knows they're not going to make a deep playoff run this year, so maybe he does try to give it a little bit more energy early in the season to really sell the Lakers. And look, I think his job this year is very clear to what it was last year, and it didn't work as well as I think people expected. Was he's got to get people to come join him in Los Angeles. Now, the young group of Lakers, and Danny can speak to this, and Roberto as well, they're a decent young group of Lakers, but they need another veteran next year. And so adding that's his job, is to make playing with the Lakers fun and exciting, and try to get another veteran to come join him next offseason. Because I believe the Lakers have room for another max contract.
Yeah, they do.
This offseason. So someone to join him. And just make it exciting, you know, bring Showtime back to Los Angeles, make it exciting to play for the Lakers again, and just get a veteran in. And then I think we're rolling next year, because, like, if Durant leaves Golden State, which we obviously don't know if he's going to do, that makes them more vulnerable. They have to pay Klay Thompson, I believe, as well. So, you know, the Warriors might not be the same team next year, and if you can improve the Lakers with a veteran in the offseason, they're viable again.
Yeah, if it's me and Danny, I know you guys out in L.A., of course, big Lakers honks. I feel like if it's me, based on the tea leaves and just based on guys that it looks like are going to leave, Anthony Davis is the guy that I would want, if I'm a Lakers fan,
yeah,
to join LeBron James next year. I think it's possible Anthony Davis is the second or third best player in the NBA. I think he would fit very well out there. I think you can get him away. I don't think he wants to stay in New Orleans, because they just don't have a winning plan behind him. They lost a couple of the guys that helped them make that little mild playoff run they had last year. I don't feel like Durant is coming there. I think if Durant's going anywhere, he's probably going to the East. I'm not sure exactly where. Maybe he goes to the Knicks. Maybe he considers Washington. I don't know exactly the salary cap situation on some of those teams. But generally speaking, if it's me and I can only get one guy to join LeBron James in a Lakers jersey next year, it's Anthony Davis.
Ooh,
you'd rather have the unibrow more so than like Dame Lillard, or how about Klay Thompson, another name that's been thrown
Anthony
out
Davis.
There.
I think I'd rather have Anthony Davis.
Yeah.
He's like a generational talent,
yes.
And to be able to run the floor at that size, to pair with they already have plenty of guards. They don't need Dame Lillard. I think Klay Thompson, obviously, with his ability to shoot, would be a great addition to the team. But
well, yeah, they don't have a guard like Damian Lillard, though, on his level.
I know, but I would rather have the all-world talent who's 7 feet tall than the point guard. Because look, LeBron can play that position if needed.
Can he shoot threes, though?
Anthony Davis can.
I know. Well, can he consistently hit threes?
But I don't know if they need that from him. I just think he's. How do you turn down an all-world talent like that over a Dame Lillard?
See, that's why Klay would be such a good fit, I think, because that's the only thing the Lakers are really, truly missing right now is a pure shooter. You need a guy that can score and can get hot and go off. And if LeBron's having an off night, he can kick the ball out to that shooter.
Does it worry you that Klay might be a different player without all those guys around him?
Yeah, a little bit.
He's more of a catch and shoot player.
Correct.
Who has certainly benefited. He has certainly benefited from the attention that Steph and KD obviously pull away. But one thing that Klay Thompson does have is incredibly quick release with his jumper. So I still think that he'd be a great fit. Don't get me wrong. I just look at Anthony Davis and say, man, that guy along with LeBron James makes them such a physical team, and it gives them a size dimension. And the one thing that we're seeing about Anthony Davis is Karl-Anthony Towns hasn't exactly blossomed quite as far as we thought maybe he would. A lot of these guys, these taller guys that are more versatile and can step out, Anthony Davis is still the cream of that crop. Nobody else can do the kinds of things that he can do and alter a game in quite the same way. So as much as I like Klay, and originally I thought, yeah, Klay going to L.A. would make a whole lot of sense, and I still think that it would. If it's me, I'm taking Anthony Davis all day long and twice on Sundays.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com and within the iHeartRadio app.
I'm going to say that the Lakers are going to win 55 games this season.
Okay.
All right.
You're wrong.
We're turning your mic off now. LeBron's going to help the Lakers win 55 games. The Dodgers are going to take care of the Brewers in six. So it's not going to go seven. The momentum is definitely on the Dodgers' side after that Kershaw performance.
I mean, you could be right about that. I've got the Lakers winning 47. The Vegas over-under is 48, which I find intriguing. So, I mean, maybe I get to 48. 47 is the number I've had in my head pretty much the entire time.
I think LeBron has a little something to prove. He's hearing about this old age thing. And that he just went to L.A. because of production and blah, 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 blah.
That is why he went there.
He has a lot left in the tank. You saw him have one of his best seasons of his career just last season. This guy is far from done, and he's got good players around him. They have really good chemistry. I say that they surprise some of the haters.
I just don't think they're that good. I think the West is too stacked. I think on a night-to-night basis, LeBron is going to get fatigued. They're going to lose some games. They're going to make it into the playoffs as a 6, 7, or 8 seed, and then we'll see what happens once they get into the postseason.
Nope. Fourth seed.
I don't think that he's
fourth seed in the West.
Out of gas.
They're going to be
fourth.
Fourth
seed in the West? Are you kidding?
Nope, I'm not kidding.
I think that's insane.
And yeah, I do live here, and yes, I am hoping for the best because I'm sick of, look, Laker fans are spoiled. I'll be the first to admit that because we had years and years of winning, but we've also had years and years of losing right now, too. So just let me dream a little bit, okay?
I mean, you can dream. As long as you recognize it as a dream, 55 would be utterly crazy.
But if that dream comes true, can you tweet me and say you were right? That's all, just that one sentence.
The month of February for the Lakers is the one that you need to pay attention to. 7 of 9 on the road, 5-game road swing through Golden State, Indiana, Boston, Philadelphia, and then they'll beat Atlanta. Then after the All-Star break, they get Houston at home, then New Orleans and Memphis, and then play New Orleans again. That's a tough, tough road. How many wins you got for the Lakers in this last half minute, Jeff?
I don't know. I don't care, man. I'm not a.
You're a fan.
I don't predict wins. I'm not going to watch the Lakers play till Christmas. So I win enough games to get a free agent to come there. That's all I care about.
Thanks. That's what we want in sports is opinions and actual statistics, and you gave us none of those things.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis, weeknights at 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
We talked some about Clayton Kershaw there towards the end of the first hour. Jeff, I'll let you go ahead and eat crow as Danny G sports the largest grin in Sherman Oaks right now.
I mean,
Clayton Kershaw was brilliant yesterday.
He was great. And I told Danny this off the air. I said to you guys, like, I was sitting there and I was, I think the second inning was kind of right as I was about to start my radio show too at 6 p.m. Eastern. So I had my iPad. I had my iPad on. I'm watching, I'm doing my radio show. And I got my phone, my app open, my Twitter app open. I was ready to just go in.
I bet you were.
On Clayton Kershaw. And then he struck out Jesus Aguilar, who's been pretty atrocious with runners on base in this. In this series so far, and then the Dodgers obviously, you know, they won the game. Little iffy at the very end with the bullpen, but he
Jeff, the rest of the Dodgers bullpen was actually good. I know there's a lot of talk about the Brewers bullpen. The Dodgers bullpen, their ERA overall is 1.62.
Yeah.
Madsen unfortunately had a rough. He gave up a couple of hits in the run there at the end, but the rest of the bullpen looked nice. And the big surprise for the Dodgers has been Pedro Baez, because he's obviously been a thorn in the side of all Dodger fans. But he's come into his own the past couple of months. As far as he can look good, he's looked good. So if Pedro Baez is pitching well, then the Dodgers are going to be looking good at the end of the series here.
Isn't there a concern about Jensen still coming off that? He hasn't quite been the same since he's been back from his month off after the heart issue. So I think that to me is the concern, is that people kind of see like he's just not quite the same guy. It'll be interesting to see. They're going to have to go to Boston, right, to for the World Series if they make it, if the Red Sox win, because it goes by record now, right?
Yeah,
they threw out that stupid rule about the All-Star game.
Yeah, now it's by record. I think the thing with Jansen is that you're now going to pitch him for one inning instead of three. Remember the postseason last year?
Yeah, he got tired. Yeah.
Yeah, he did. And there's no way you can do that now with his health concerns. So that's why the setup role is even that much more important. The Dodgers have a couple of arms in there that can set things up right now, but I would not put Kenley in unless it's just for an inning because of what's going on with his heart. And can you imagine this? He's having a procedure during the offseason where they basically burn off the part of your heart that's causing the problem. And this guy
doesn't sound good.
Yeah, and he's like, "Oh, I'll just do it in the offseason, guys."
It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm gonna play the postseason.
And he took like 3 weeks off and came back. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable that he's still pitching, considering what's
now as far as Kershaw. I knew it too. I imagined you, because Roberto and I, we were both in attendance. Yeah. That crowd was rocking.
It was loud.
Yeah, I got to give a lot of credit to the Dodger fans. The place filled up entirely by the third inning. It was hard getting in. I mean, I left Burbank at noon for a 2:09 p.m. start, and it was still hard for me to get to the stadium. And I left at noon. And the stadium's 15 minutes away from where I live normally. So you can imagine people not having to take the day off from work, having to get in through all that traffic to the stadium. Once they announced we were now on the national TV, the towels were waving, the crowd got loud, and the crowd stayed loud even when the Dodgers were trailing. And then when they finally tied it up, the place went nuts, and Puig kind of opened up that lead. The best part of the game was when Clayton Kershaw was hustling around the bases.
Yeah.
That was the best part, because that's what we know about
Johnny
him.
Hustle.
Yes, he really was. But that right there, that epitomizes the guy. He plays so hard. And yeah, sometimes his curveball is off. Yesterday it was spectacular, but sometimes it's off. Sometimes, as Jeff pointed out yesterday, his back hurts and he tires out. That was not the case yesterday. It almost seemed like he could have went a complete game yesterday.
Right, yeah, but I think they took him out at the right point for a couple of reasons. One is that we've seen historically the third time through the order is tough for him. And look, he's pitched great. Get him out now with a lead. And also, if you have to bring him back for any reason, all at game seven, I don't know how the schedule sets up to even get him an inning or two. If you need him, he's still there, right? Because if you have him pitch an extra inning or throw an extra 30 pitches, maybe he can't come back and a short rest and throw an inning if you have to in game seven. So it made sense to take him out there. He pitched great yesterday. He looked like himself. And the reason why him and David Price don't get the same comparison is because Clayton Kershaw's a Hall of Famer. He's like the best pitcher in the last 10 years. David Price is not that. And that's why David Price doesn't get the grief that, that Kershaw does. Plus, a lot of Price's postseason issues are against one team, which is the Yankees. He can't pitch against the Yankees for whatever reason. And so that's why I think as well as we've seen Kershaw and it's throughout his career have, you know, have games like this in the postseason, but also have games where he allows a lot of runs. So I had to eat my words last night. He pitched great.